Welcome to Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU at 89.1 FM, the show that brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. I'm Donna Stevens, the Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, a local watershed protection nonprofit, and your host for today's program. Joining me here in the studio is Michael Robinson, conservation advocate with the Center for Biological Diversity, and we're going to talk about two highly endangered mammals, the Mexican gray wolf and the jaguar. Welcome, Michael.
Good morning, Donna. Thank you.
So I wanted to start with a recent setback to wolves in the Southwest. There's actually been a few. So on June 10th, a federal district court dealt a blow to the Mexican gray wolf recovery program. I read a headline stating, "Court enjoins releases of Mexican gray wolves in New Mexico." That's enjoins, not enjoys.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, it means a federal court stopped the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service from releasing wolves into New Mexico, endangered Mexican gray wolves. And that was at the behest of New Mexico as a state and the New Mexico Game and Fish Department. Essentially, the Susana Martinez administration sought to block further releases of wolves and even to do more damage. And they've got a temporary injunction. We hope it's temporary. We'll see how long it lasts, blocking the Fish and Wildlife Service from releasing wolves while the case is being heard.
On what legal grounds did the judge rule in favor of the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish? What was his reasoning?
Well, the reasoning is a little complex, but essentially he held that the state of New Mexico had a greater interest as the case develops in stopping the release than the federal government had in allowing wolves to be released and contribute to the gene pool. The basis of it, in part, was that the population of wolves is labeled experimental and non-essential, which is a bit of a legal fiction because biologically they are absolutely essential to the further conservation, survival, and eventual recovery of their type, of the Mexican gray wolf. And I think we respectfully disagree with the judge's ruling in that. We think that the Endangered Species Act is very clear that even experimental non-essential species have to be recovered, or populations have to be part of eventually a recovered species. So we think it was not a correct ruling, but we'll see where it goes from here.
So I understand that in that ruling, the Game Commission, the New Mexico Game Commission, or is it the Department of New Mexico Game and Fish?
Well, it's the department that is the plaintiff, but certainly they're governed by the commission, which is appointed by Governor Martinez.
Okay. So they lost, the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish lost on one of their issues in the lawsuit against U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services. What did Game and Fish want that the judge did not grant them?
Well, they had an even farther-reaching aim. They wanted removal of two wolf pups that had been placed in a den for a so-called cross-fostering in New Mexico. An established wolf family is now raising them, as far as we know. And they wanted those wolves removed from the wild after they had been placed with this new wolf family. And thankfully, the judge did not grant that request. And that would have meant that those pups could never have been returned to their original families because they had been gone long enough, and they probably would not have been accepted back. They would have had to be hand-reared, and they would not have been eligible even as adults for future release even after this case is resolved. So that would have been certainly a huge downturn for these two individual wolves' lives, but also would have been an additional setback for the population, which badly needs infusions of new genes, new DNA, into the depauperate gene pool of the Mexican gray wolf.
Why couldn't those two pups be released with their natural parents?
Well, they could have been, and that question really shines a bit of a light into the political decision making. The reason they weren't released with their parents is the Fish and Wildlife Service erroneously thought that they might be able to get less opposition from the usual suspects that always oppose anything that might benefit this endangered animal, the Mexican wolf. They thought that perhaps the livestock industry wouldn't be as adamantly opposed to pups being released than adults. But the livestock industry and as we see the its allies in Governor Martinez's administration really are absolutist in this. They want zero wolves. They've expressed that on numerous occasions. So they weren't about to try and meet the Fish and Wildlife Service halfway. And so it was a political decision to take these wolf pups from their parents and release them and have them raised by different parents. It's an experimental technique. It's risky. There's no guarantee that it's going to work. But it was done in a failed effort to assuage some of the opposition.
So those pups are still out there with their foster family.
The Fish and Wildlife Service has reported just earlier this week that at least one pup in that foster family, as you say, the Sheep Herders Baseball Park pack in the northern part of the Gila, one pup at least is surviving, and we don't know if that was one of the original pups that pack had or whether it was one of the two cross-fostered, and we hope certainly that more than one pup is alive still.
Okay. So why is the New Mexico, this perhaps sounds a bit naive, but for our listeners who haven't been paying attention to this for a long time, why is the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish so opposed to Mexican gray wolves? What are some of their concerns, and are they legitimate?
Well, I mean, the concerns expressed are sort of a shifting series of rationales that that depend on the convenience of the moment. The actual concerns, again, it comes down to raw politics. The Martinez administration has cast its fortunes with the politically powerful livestock industry, and they want to show the livestock industry that they can, they can give it something. So the actual rationales, of course, are not so baldly stated as we're just against wolf recovery. They've expressed concerns about livestock depredations, even though those are pretty infrequent and negligible from a, when you consider the over a million head of livestock in the state of New Mexico and the hundreds of thousands that are in the southern part of the state, insignificant numbers are taken by wolves. And though there's a fund that is available, actually more than one fund available, to indemnify the owners of livestock that are taken by wolves. So it should be a non-issue, but of course that doesn't mean people can't make hay over it. And they've also expressed what I think are spurious concerns about human safety. Of course, wolves, like any other wild animal, are potentially dangerous to humanity. But there's been no instance of a Mexican wolf, ever threatening a person. So those are some of the concerns. And then they reach a little further afield, and they note that there hasn't been a recovery plan for the Mexican gray wolf that has recovery criteria, which is something the Center for Biological Diversity and many biologists and the conservation community at large have been very concerned about for a long time. And we've gone to court and we've made some progress in that respect, and we can talk about that in a little bit. But it's not a concern that the state of New Mexico had expressed before it became a convenient forum for opposing any kind of management that could improve the lot of these wolves. So they sort of grab whatever they seems convenient at the time as a rationale to oppose Mexican wolves.
Because when that wolf recovery plan does come out, and we will talk about that later, they probably won't like that either, isn't that right?
Well, not necessarily, and we can get into it, but the state of New Mexico, along with states of Arizona, Colorado, and Utah, have sort of ganged up on the Fish and Wildlife Service and have gotten themselves a series of closed-door meetings in which apparently they're dictating to Fish and Wildlife Service what that future recovery plan will look like. So we have grave concerns about where that's going, but it's still a process underway.
Okay. Has the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service appealed this decision, and what's the next step?
They have not appealed this adverse federal court ruling banning them from releasing wolves. They have until early August to make a decision on an appeal. We certainly think that on the law, an appeal is very justified, and certainly on the merits of whether the Mexican wolf is going to recover or not. This is a really urgent juncture, and we hope the federal government will appeal. Also, I should mention that members of the conservation community, and specifically four conservation groups, including the one that I work for, Center for Biological Diversity, and our partners, Defenders of Wildlife and Wild Earth Guardians, and the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, we have all requested to intervene into this court case on the side of the federal government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, to have a chance to to argue this case as a whole, is, and we would like to be able to appeal specifically this ruling, but we have not yet. The state of New Mexico has opposed our being a party to the lawsuit. They want to keep us out of the pleadings, and the judge has not yet decided on whether we will be accepted as intervener defendants.
Why do they want to keep you from intervening? What are the repercussions of, or the consequences of you guys intervening?
Well, I mean, the consequence is merely that we'll be able to put forth arguments, perhaps different arguments than the federal government might plan to argue. We certainly have been involved from certainly well before the reintroduction. In fact, the Center for Biological Diversity was one of the litigants in a lawsuit that compelled the federal government to reintroduce wolves. And so we certainly have different interests from the federal government that we need to be able to express in court. And the state of New Mexico has expressed concerns that somehow our intervention might delay the proceedings, and they have stated erroneously that our interests are identical with the government, which is a little farcical when you consider that the only reason the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service actually moved ahead, finally this year, releasing two wolf pups in the Gila, is because of a petition that the Center for Biological Diversity wrote, that I wrote for the Center for Biological Diversity, and that we filed back in 2004, and then two lawsuits to compel the Fish and Wildlife Service to actually read the petition and respond to it, which were in 2006 and then 2012. And that led to a rulemaking process in which thousands of people had the opportunity and took that opportunity to weigh in, both pro and con and every direction in between, on releasing wolves in the Gila. And other management changes. And we certainly did not get everything we wanted. And we're actually suing the government because, as on the other side of things, the flip side to the new release authority, there's also new authority to kill wolves in all kinds of circumstances that weren't available before. So we're hardly aligned with the federal government on everything or in the broader picture here. And we think that we deserve a right to make arguments independent of the government. We'll see what the judge decides.
Well, if you were in alignment with the federal government, you wouldn't need to intervene. Isn't that true?
Well, yeah, I think that's true. I mean, if we had confidence that they would represent our position in a vigorous and effective manner, we certainly wouldn't need to intervene.
So what are these new methods that you just alluded to for new ways that people can kill wolves? What's that about?
Well, that was part of the package of changes that was implemented a little over a year ago, a year and a half ago, really, back in January of 2015. And there's multiple new authorities to destroy wolves, both for the federal government to destroy wolves, for the state government to demand the federal government destroy wolves on its behalf, and for private individuals to do so. And it really is antithetical to what scientists have been saying for a long time, which is basically two pretty simple to understand points. Release wolves into the wild to enhance the gene pool and cure the problem of inbreeding, which is really afflicting the wolves in a terrible way right now. And on the other side, stop shooting them. Stop trapping them and removing them to captivity. And the Fish and Wildlife Service instead, as I said, opened up new authorities. So, for example, under the January 2015 rule, states, for example, New Mexico or Arizona, can demand that wolves be killed because they're killing too many so-called elk or deer or other hoofed mammals, ungulates. And the Fish and Wildlife Service would then have to go through a process that may very well lead to those animals being killed. In other words, they're not supposed to kill livestock. Everybody knows that, and they very rarely do. But in addition to that, they're not supposed to kill, as it turns out, very many of their natural prey, which leaves these wolves in an obvious bind and gave impetus over a year ago to the Arizona Republic editorializing with a snarky but very accurate headline, "What are they supposed to do, go out for pizza?" And so that's one of the new opportunities that states have to destroy wolves. Another that's really extraordinarily problematic, both for the wolf population as well as for the as a precedent for other endangered species, is that if the wolf population ever grows to 325 animals in the combination of New Mexico and Arizona, so vast area, and then it grows one animal beyond that, that last animal has to be removed from the wild. Or if there's 50 pups at that point, if we ever get to that point, you know, and there's 375 animals on the ground, then 50 have to be removed arbitrarily, notwithstanding that some of them may be very genetically important or otherwise could contribute to recovery of their species. They would have to be either taken into captivity, where there's probably wouldn't be no room for them, or placed somewhere else, i.e. Mexico, where there may or may not be room for them in the wild. There's a reintroduction program there as well. Or they would have to be gunned down. And we think that's just outrageous and completely at odds with the whole intent of the Endangered Species Act.
Okay, well, the news is worse than I even recognized. We're going to be right back after this short break to continue our conversation about Mexican gray wolves with Michael Robinson here on Earth Matters. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's program. And joining me here in the studio is Michael Robinson of the Center for Biological Diversity. And we're talking about some recent developments with endangered Mexican gray wolves. And later on in the program, we'll be talking about another endangered mammal, the jaguar. So, Michael, before the break, we were talking about some politics with the New Mexico Game Commission and the Game and Fish Department. And I understand that a while back, the Game Commission denied the latter ranch's permit to house Mexican gray wolves and prepare them for release, which they'd already been doing for about 17 years. Then the commission decided earlier this year to renew the latter ranch's permit, but only to allow those wolves to be released into Mexico. What's the deal here?
Well, the state of New Mexico, along with, as I mentioned earlier in regards to recovery planning, states of Arizona, Colorado, and Utah, are pushing to limit where wolves in the United States would inhabit for their eventual recovery, and as I indicated, to limit their numbers. So they want to. They've already incorporated the cap, the hard cap of 325 animals in combined New Mexico and Arizona, into last year's management plan, and they'd like to incorporate that into a longer term recovery plan as well, which again would be unprecedented to put a cap on the number of an endangered species in a recovery plan. So in order to justify that, they have to say, well, you know, there's going to be enough wolves somewhere else to address the concerns and the problems pointed out by, in particular, by geneticists who point out that these wolves are all highly related to each other, the ones in the wild, and that they need a lot more from those in captivity, and eventually a much more robust, larger population to be able to express all the different iterations, if you will, of the genetic diversity that did survive with the Mexican wolf. There's more of that diversity in the captive population at the moment than in the wild population. So they want to limit the numbers, but they have to point to where wolves could be to address these genetic problems, and they say, well, south of the border in Mexico, we'll make the bulk of the recovery happen there. And so to facilitate that, they have allowed the latter ranch to serve as a pass-through, because the captive breeding program has some 50-odd facilities, most of them are in the United States, and many of them are quite distant from the border with Mexico. So when you're talking about transporting live animals from, you know, for example, a facility in New York State or in Washington State or wherever, it's good to have a place where they can just get out of the, you know, very small kennels for a little bit and, you know, before they're eventually brought to their release site. And that's what the latter ranch is now permitted to do.
But they're going to release them in Mexico.
Yes.
I mean, is there a lot of public land in Mexico to accommodate them?
There's very little public land in Mexico, which is one of its grave challenges as for future recovery of Mexican wolves. Now, of course, Mexican wolves are native to Mexico, and it is very important to recover them there. But really, of course, back in the day, there was no border. There was no separate population of wolves in Mexico and in southern New Mexico. They went back and forth. And, of course, genetically, that is important as well for spread of genes and the ability of little subpopulations, as it did eventually become fragmented, to survive as well. So now Fish and Wildlife Service is going in the direction urged by these the four corner states, including New Mexico, of putting the bulk of the onus for recovery in Mexico, despite the very little public lands that there were there and perhaps low capacity to support the sufficient number of wolves for genetic reasons that would be necessary at this point.
Well, we've already covered some bad news, but unfortunately there's more. So after we scheduled this interview last week, I heard some more bad news in the Mexican gray wolf world. And in the last month or so, I understand that three more wolves have been shot. What can you tell us about this?
Well, first of all, I don't know that it's necessarily correct that they have been shot, although that is certainly a likely outcome. They have been, the Fish and Wildlife Service has announced that they have died and that their deaths are under investigation, and typically they don't release necropsy results or they do it sporadically and erratically. So we may not know for a long time how these animals died, but it is under investigation, which suggests that it was an illegal killing. And there have been dozens of wolves that have been illegally shot since this reintroduction program began 18 years ago. And dozens more that have disappeared, many in suspicious circumstances. We're talking about radio-colored wolves that just are not seen again. So without being able to comment, I have no information on these three latest cases. I do think it's important to note that there are responses on a policy level that could make these wolves much safer than they are. And one of them is simply to withdraw the radio telemetry receivers that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has loaned to livestock owners in the Gila National Forest and elsewhere where wolves roam to enable them to locate wolves, ostensibly to protect their livestock. But it's a very powerful tool that strips these wolves of their ability to stay hidden. And in the past, the Fish and Wildlife Service has admitted that it didn't even keep records sufficient to know who they had given these telemetry receivers out to as loans. So certainly they weren't able to retrieve them. But even though they are keeping better records now, we think that it's imprudent, given the extraordinarily high number, in fact, unprecedentedly high number of wolves that are turning up dead with bullets in them, or just, as I said, disappearing suspiciously. In some cases, two wolves that are both radio-collared, that are known to be traveling together, seen repeatedly together, that both disappear at the same time. And the Fish and Wildlife Service sometimes suggests their radio collars went dead at the same time. That doesn't strike me as likely as maybe they were being tracked by people who had these telemetry receivers and shot or otherwise done in at the same time. So given these unsolved crimes that are really putting the Mexican wolf survival at risk, and certainly its recovery at grave risk, it seems extraordinarily imprudent to be giving away telemetry receivers that strip these wolves of their ability to stay hidden, as I said, giving them away like candy. And we think that they should be confined to people with the government whose jobs it is to, keep track of these wolves, and to legitimate researchers. They shouldn't be given to people who've expressed their enmity of the wolves, although they certainly have the right to disagree with wolf reintroduction. But I don't think that it makes sense to be continuing lending these out. And that would be a big step forward to keeping these animals protected, in my view.
Do you have a telemetry receiver, for
instance? No, I don't qualify. I am not a livestock owner. And then there's what is perhaps an informal criteria. Certainly, they've never written this down for – in fact, I don't think they've written down any criteria for distributing these. Actually, I'm mistaken in that. They have put a few paragraphs down in writing about this. But anyway, the informal criteria seems to be that you have to detest wolves. So, no, I have not been offered one.
No comment. So the Mexican gray wolf, they're the most endangered mammal in North America. Is that true?
Well, I mean, sadly, there's several other species that are creeping up there as highly imperiled as well. But they have been identified back in the 1980s. They were identified as the most endangered mammal in North America by a Fish and Wildlife Service biologist who's very, very well qualified. And even though there are some other mammals that are in dire straits as well, certainly the Mexican wolf is one of the ones in the worst peril.
So given that this animal is highly imperiled, if not the most endangered mammal, can you give our listeners some context for these latest deaths? What does this mean for the survival of wolves?
Well, it's unclear because we don't know, first of all, how many wolf pups have been born this spring, and we certainly don't know how many of them will be alive, you know, several months from now. There's, in the best of circumstances, life is not guaranteed for wolves and certainly not for their young as well. There's all kinds of dangers. And, you know, as we've noted, this is not the best of circumstances for the Mexican gray wolf. The dangers are compounded by a few people who bear them great hatred. So it's hard to put it into context. We do know that at the last count of the wolves, which took place this January, there were 97 wolves found alive in New Mexico and Arizona combined, roughly split half and half, 47 in New Mexico, 50 in Arizona. And there was, I'm trying to remember the number of breeding pairs, and it's slipping my mind right now, but I want to say something like 4 or 5 breeding pairs. There was a decline from last year, both in the number of breeding pairs and in the number of wolves. It was a 12% decline in the number of wolves from last year. So we don't know whether that decline is going to continue. We know that every year there are illegal killings of Mexican wolves. It's hard to put the deaths of these three animals in context at this point.
Okay. So, I mean, if we look at when the recovery program started, which I believe was 1998, is that true? What was the goal that was stated then in terms of how many wolves on the ground in breeding pairs?
Well, the reintroduction, let me clarify a couple of things. The reintroduction program started in 1998. The recovery program is supposed to be a much broader effort that at the moment doesn't have any end goals. So the 4 decades ago, almost 4 decades ago, back in 1982, the Fish and Wildlife Service did come out with a Mexican wolf recovery plan, but as I noted earlier, it didn't have any recovery criteria. It said, as a first step, there should be 100 wolves on the ground through reintroduction, at least 100 wolves, it said, and that at least is important, in one area of its historic range, and as a second step, a second population should also be established, and it specified both these populations should be viable, which is a word that's taken on more specificity in the decades since, as there's been great advances in the science of viability, in particular in light of genetic advances since 1982. And this population is certainly not viable, nor is the population of under 25 wolves that have been released in the last, or reintroduced in the last 5 years in Mexico. That, too, is not viable. So that as the incomplete recovery sort of outline, certainly not goals, as background, the reintroduction project, which began in 1998, didn't have goals per se, but what it had was it did have one goal, which is at least 100 wolves in the wild. But its projections may be more illuminating. It projected that there would be 102 wolves, including 18 breeding pairs, on the ground by 2006, and the population has only once had 102 wolves. That was last year. Now, as I noted, there were below that at 97 wolves, and it's never come close to 18 breeding pairs.
Okay, well, please stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break to continue our conversation about Mexican gray wolves and jaguars with Michael Robinson. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 on your FM dial. This is Donna Stevens, your host for today's program. My guest today is Michael Robinson of the Center for Biological Diversity, and we're talking about some recent developments with endangered Mexican gray wolves and jaguars. Michael, we've been talking in the first half of the show about some bad news when it comes to wolf recovery, and hasn't there been kind of a recent victory? I mean, I understand that Fish and Wildlife Service finally agreed to complete a legally required Mexican wolf recovery plan. You've talked about this a little bit, but can you tell us more about this, what this recovery plan is and why it's significant?
Sure. So a recovery plan is required in the Endangered Species Act, and it's essentially a scientific roadmap to how to get any particular species, whether it's a wildlife species or a native plant for that matter, to get it from the brink of extinction to the point where it's secure, long-term secure, and can be taken off of the endangered species list or the threatened species list. Threatened species are slightly less or somewhat less endangered than endangered species. So, as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, the Fish and Wildlife Service did develop a recovery plan back in 1982 that sort of gave a start to recovery efforts. But it certainly didn't point the way to the end because it did not include recovery criteria. Nothing definite about when the Mexican wolf could be considered you know, safe and taken off the endangered species list. And they were clear about why they didn't include it. They said this animal is, and this is a paraphrase, but they said this animal is so close to the brink of extinction, we can't imagine it being recovered. And we don't have the knowledge at this point to specify what that would look like. You know, let's get two populations out there in the wild, make sure they're viable, and then we can figure out in a revision of the recovery plan what those recovery criteria should be. And so then Fish and Wildlife Service, having said developed this recovery plan, they said it was good for 2.5 years back in 1982. Well, then they didn't revise it. Finally, in the 1990s, they began a process of revising the recovery plan. They got so far as to get a draft. The draft, all it would have needed is a public comment period in case people had additional information to include in it, and eventually the signature of the regional director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But having written this draft, the Fish and Wildlife Service never put it out for public comment and never finalized it. So it just sat in a drawer somewhere in the Fish and Wildlife Service's offices. And then they, in 2003, they set up a new recovery team, and I was on it as representing the Center for Biological Diversity as a so-called stakeholder, along with many, many other stakeholders from the livestock industry and the hunting outfitting industry and some states that opposed wolves and the like, and some scientists who are very, very well qualified. And we diligently worked for 2 years, and then when we were coming close to coming out with a draft, the Fish and Wildlife Service postponed a meeting of the recovery team and then canceled the next meeting after it had been postponed and never reconvened the meetings, and several years later disbanded the team. And then they formed a new team in 2010, and it's almost like, you know, history just repeats itself. The new team, the scientists came out with a draft plan. It needed to be worked with the stakeholder group of the team and eventually go out for public comment, but none of that happened. As soon as the scientists came out with a draft plan, Fish and Wildlife Service canceled the next scheduled meeting, never rescheduled, came up with various excuses why not. And so eventually, the conservation community went to court. The Center for Biological Diversity, Defenders of Wildlife, the Endangered Wolf Center, and David Parsons, who's a former Mexican wolf recovery coordinator, retired from the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Wolf Conservation Center. So Endangered Wolf Center and Wolf Conservation Center are two of the places, the nonprofits that breed these wolves in captivity for eventual release in the wild. So we all sued the Fish and Wildlife Service saying, you can't just keep postponing this for another 3.5 decades. You got to actually get it done. And the Fish and Wildlife Service was resistant, but they did eventually settle the lawsuit or agree to a settlement agreement. The settlement agreement would have the Fish and Wildlife Service complete a recovery plan by November of 2017, which frankly is way more time than they need. They've got all the information. They should just start with the last draft the scientists came out with. But instead, they're turning to the state's anti-wolf plans, which would, you know, put the onus, as I mentioned earlier, of recovery on the nation of Mexico with much fewer wolves here in the United States. But there at least is a deadline to get it done, and that deadline will actually be in effect if the judge approves the settlement agreement. The livestock industry has intervened on the side of the government, and they are arguing that there should not be a deadline set and that this settlement agreement should be rejected. And so the judge has yet to decide.
So they want to just delay it endlessly,
apparently
the livestock
so.
Industry? Yeah. Okay, wow. So I want to ask you, Michael, in your view, what needs to happen right now to get the recovery program back on track and to really get serious about recovering these wolves?
Well, it's a great question, Donna. And just, you know, from the recovery plan standpoint, the first step would be take that recovery plan, the draft recovery plan that some of the country's best carnivore scientists came out with just about 4 years ago, and put it out for public comment. If there's additional science that can be incorporated, that can come out in the public comment process, there should be a peer review process. Make whatever changes are merited and get the job done this year. You don't even have to wait, Fish and Wildlife Service, until November of 2017. Get the job this year and ignore what you were told in the closed-door meetings with the politicos from the state of New Mexico, Utah, Colorado, and Arizona who've been fighting against wolf recovery. Just throw out the closed-door meetings and stick with the science and open the process up for public comment. That would be the way to go, and it would save taxpayer money, and it would really come out, you know, with the most robust scientific document necessary to recover this critically imperiled animal. So that would be the roadmap, as I describe a recovery plan, as a scientific roadmap. That would be how to the best way to get to that. And then stop trapping and shooting wolves. Just let the wolves stay out there. The ranchers are being reimbursed for their lost livestock. And there's just no reason for recovery to put bullets into wolves and disrupt families, leave pups orphaned, leave wolves without mates, a whole array of horrific aftermaths of this kind of systematic mismanagement. And close some of these loopholes that allow that really are so destructive. One way to do it would be just to settle the lawsuit with the conservation community in which we're taking issue with these loopholes. You know, do it on a scientific basis. Just throw the politics out is what, again, I would urge the Fish and Wildlife Service to do. And appeal this adverse court ruling that we believe unjustly and without a correct basis in law prevents the Fish and Wildlife Service from releasing wolves into New Mexico. Get that in front of an appellate court. Make the arguments robustly, although we certainly believe that the conservation community absolutely needs to be in the courtroom, so to speak, as an intervener making these arguments as well. But that would be the way to do it, is regain the authority and then release family groups of wolves rather than this experimental cross-fostering, which failed in its intended purpose of trying to get the opponents of wolf recovery to meet them halfway. That was the purpose of taking these wolves, these pups from their parents and giving them to new parents. It was essentially a political token, and it didn't work as a political token. So do it the way that people know can be done and would work biologically. Put family groups out there. One of the failings of Fish and Wildlife Service's approach, and it's really ironic because they claim that they're so scientific in this, but they look at these animals as automatons, not as highly social animals that have family groups and, in fact, rely on their family groups for successful raising of pups, for successful bringing down of large prey. And so they, for example, they strip them of their sex. Instead of saying he or she, they refer to them as it, which doesn't provide more information. It's just, from the point of view of the English language, it's wrong. And they try and get people to think like they think of these animals as just sort of pieces on a chessboard or something. And that's the wrong approach. It's the unscientific approach when you're dealing with a highly social animal. So that's a bit of a digression. But, release these wolves as family groups. Scientists and the conservation community have urged 5 releases of wolf packs by early 2016. Well, that obviously did not happen. But we really need to bolster the declining genetic diversity of the wolf population in the wild. And so the freeze on releases has to be broken. And more wolves could be released in Arizona as well under existing authority. But again, Fish and Wildlife Service will only do what Arizona Game and Fish allows it to do. They're on a short leash with these state masters. They apparently don't know who won the Civil War, and so they are not releasing wolves in Arizona, or they've released 4 pups again without their parents. They should do it right in Arizona, and they should just do it according to what the scientists say, not what the politicos in Arizona say.
Well, there you have it.
if scientists and people who cared about the natural world were making decisions.
Right. Wouldn't things be different? Well, I want to turn now to talking about another highly endangered mammal, the jaguar. And the jaguar was listed as endangered in the U.S. in 1997 in response to a Center for Biological Diversity campaign. Isn't that true?
Yes, it is true. Yeah, the Fish and Wildlife Service had protected the jaguar under the Endangered Species Act south of the border, and then they said that they weren't protected north of the border, and then they resisted getting them back on, and we did prevail with protests and lawsuits and got them on the endangered species list wherever they live.
So that was my next question. I understand that the center has sued the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service 3 times to obtain a recovery plan and for Fish and Wildlife to designate critical habitat. And then in early 2010, the service announced that it would grant the jaguar protected habitat in the U.S. and develop a recovery plan. Where does that stand today?
Well, they did finally designate critical habitat for jaguars last year, and we can talk about some of the specifics of that in a little bit, but they have not yet completed a recovery plan, and here we are over 6 years later, and what they resisted from the outset, they are going very, very slowly at right now.
So the center proposed the designation of more than 50 million acres of jaguar critical habitat in the Southwest, and Fish and Wildlife Service finalized a designation of just over 764,000 acres, which is really just a mere fraction of the area your organization recommended. And unfortunately, they omitted the rugged Gila headwaters in New Mexico and the Mogollon Rim in Arizona. Why did they omit these areas where jaguars traditionally lived, historically lived?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, there's a bifurcated answer. There's the real reason, and then there's the rationales, which really don't hold up. So the real reason, in my view, is not wanting to offend the livestock industry, which was, just as with the Mexican gray wolf, the political impetus and the beneficiary, or at least they saw themselves that way, of a campaign to exterminate the jaguar. And the prime opposition to jaguar recovery comes from the livestock industry and its supporters in state and federal government. So that seems to be the bottom line. The actual rationales are far more bizarre than that, of why the Gila and the Mogollon Rim were not included as critical habitat. The Fish and Wildlife Service set up a process for evaluating habitat that included, or the potential of designating critical habitat, that included an evaluation of where jaguars had been in the past, but they put an arbitrary cutoff of 50 years in the past. Now, this was back in 2012, and of course, going back 50 years from 2012 was 1962, and they said, okay, we'll start with any jaguar occurrences that we can prove from 1962 onwards, and then we'll apply all these other criteria, which they applied in order to whittle down the habitat further. Well, a jaguar had been killed in the Apache National Forest, very close to the Gila National Forest in Arizona, where Mexican wolves now roam, incidentally, back in 1963. And not only that, but she was a female. And since then, only male jaguars have been known in the United States. Since this is over 100 miles, maybe 150 miles from the border with Mexico, and since typically in large carnivores such as jaguars, the females roam a lot less, far away from where they're born than males do, it stands to reason that perhaps she was born in that area and didn't come up from Mexico. And in fact, 4 months after she was killed, a male jaguar was killed just about 3 miles away from where she was killed. There's always the possibility they had been from the same family. Well, Fish and Wildlife Service decided they didn't want any jaguar critical habitat in the area that really would be the best for the jaguars, which is the Gila and the Mogollon Plateau, the Mogollon Rim. So they came out with this outlandish theory, or it wasn't even a theory, it was just speculation, that this jaguar had actually been taken from Guatemala and released in Arizona. And it was just bizarre because there was a series of rumors that they cited as justification. And then when we did an Open Records Act request to get, this is they cited to the Arizona Department of Game and Fish information. Then when we did an Open Records Act request to Arizona for anything having to do with this, it turns out everything they had stated that in fact this 1963 jaguar was, you know, was from that area, that there was no evidence whatsoever, and that their rumors actually applied to, if they were even true, which is, I think, unlikely, applied to other areas in Arizona, different time frames, and this jaguar couldn't have been brought over in any kind of way that anybody was speculating about. Had to be born there. But on this basis, nonetheless, Fish and Wildlife Service said this jaguar doesn't count. It's controversial.
Okay, well, we're going to be right back after this break. We'll continue our conversation about jaguars with Michael Robertson here on Earth Matters. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's show, and my guest is Michael Robinson of the Center for Biological Diversity. And in this last part of the show, we are talking about jaguars. So recently, or in the last couple of years, the only documented wild jaguar in the United States lives shockingly close to Tucson. He's a male wandering in the Santa Rita Mountains, and he's been captured on video on remote sensor cameras several times, and this video footage has been publicly released, and if our listeners are interested in watching it, it's pretty interesting. You can view it on the Center for Biological Diversity's website. This jaguar has been named El Jefe after a contest in Tucson. School children named him. And he lives in an area that is protected critical habitat. So that sounds really good, right? But it turns out that his home still really is not safe. El Jefe has been photographed less than half a mile from the proposed Rosemont mine, which would be a massive open-pit copper mine. What can you tell us about this, Michael?
Well, it's a very problematic situation that Fish and Wildlife Service has identified this region, including the Santa Rita Mountains southeast of Tucson, as necessary for the recovery of jaguars. That's what critical habitat essentially boils down to, an area that an endangered animal, or for that matter plant, species needs in order to be taken off the endangered species list and to be safe in. And as you know, the only known jaguar in the United States today is actually living in this area and has been photographed within actually the footprint, if it were to take place, of the mine, which would turn this exquisite mountain range, or a big chunk of it, into a 3,000-foot deep open pit for copper extraction, and would do tremendous damage, would obliterate, of course, the habitat that the jaguar is using, and also the habitat for many, many other rare, imperiled, and endangered species of wildlife, everything from southwestern willow flycatchers that rely on riparian vegetation downstream of where the mine would be, and the water would basically go in reverse. It would drop down into this 3,000-foot pit instead of going down the natural drainage that it's been going down for many thousands of years. Yellow-billed cuckoos, another rare animal that was just placed on the threatened species list. Fish such as the Gila top minnow, snakes such as the Mexican garter snake, whole host of endangered wildlife, and also plants, the Huachuca water umbel, which is a plant in the parsley family that, as its name suggests, relies on water. It's sort of a floating plant in springs, cienegas in the Sky Island Mountains. The Coleman coral root is an exquisite orchid, just lovely, lovely, very rare plants. All of these life forms would be further imperiled. And so as to the question, well, how can they do that in critical habitat? The Fish and Wildlife Service has given the Forest Service the okay to approve this permit in the form of a biological opinion on the impacts on endangered species. And in the case of the jaguar, they point out that jaguars walk around. And they say, well, this jaguar can just move somewhere else. It won't affect it. And they have come up with a twisted definition of what constitutes the harm to critical habitat of endangered species in order to justify this, and presumably to justify the similar destructive activities in other endangered species critical habitats. What they say is that if the habitat is still usable, any portion of the habitat is still usable by the species, then it really isn't harming it, even if they destroy huge chunks of it, as the proposed mine in the Santa Rita Mountains would do.
It doesn't really sound like critical habitat is that effective.
Well, it is tremendously effective, and in fact, a study that that scientists, both inside and independent of the Center for Biological Diversity, conducted, a review showed that endangered species that have critical habitat designated for them are twice as likely to be making progress toward their recovery goals as those that don't. And that makes sense. If you protect the homes of endangered wildlife or native plants, they're obviously going to do much better than if you let those homes get destroyed. So we don't think that the interpretation of the protections that critical habitat provides, that Fish and Wildlife Service offers, we don't think that has any basis in law. And it certainly is inimical to the survival of El Jefe and future jaguars that we hope will follow him into the United States. And so we have notified the Fish and Wildlife Service that they have violated the law, and that unless they withdraw this biological opinion, we will file suit. We would much rather not go through a court case on this. We think the law is obviously on our side, and we hope the Fish and Wildlife Service comes to its senses, frankly.
Right. Well, I understand. I should change my question slightly. I know that critical habitat is highly effective, but only if it's observed, only if it isn't violated.
Yes, absolutely. And when you come up with these bizarre legal interpretations that defy the common sense, interpretation of what Congress wrote in there, then we think it's time for the judiciary to evaluate that and come up with a corrective.
Right. So the Center for Biological Diversity has opposed walling off the U.S.-Mexico border so that jaguars can always have access to their full range, can move freely back and forth across the border. Fish and Wildlife Service has also said that the border wall wouldn't hurt the species. Where does this stand today? Is the border wall completed in the area where jaguars live?
Well, thankfully, the border wall does not extend across the entire border, but it certainly has done tremendous damage. I mean, just very roughly, one-third of the U.S.-Mexico border has what they call pedestrian barriers, which prevent you know, pedestrian humans from walking across, but also pedestrian jaguars for that matter. And then there's also what they call vehicle barriers on much of the rest of the border, which is something that, you know, is not a barrier in and of itself to a jaguar crossing. And I should note that it's not just jaguars, but about 30 endangered species are harmed by the border wall, including Mexican gray wolves. As I noted, there's some in Mexico as well, and they do need in the long term to be able to go back and forth. At the moment, the border where the Mexican wolves are, south of basically the New Mexico-Arizona line, there is no wall right there, and there is no... There is significant portions of where jaguars have crossed in the past that is not walled off, but there are also areas, such as the Buenos Aires National Wildlife Refuge, which abuts onto Mexico and has been walled off, that jaguars very likely used in the past and can't anymore, at least cross the border there. So there's been some significant damage done to the prospects for jaguar recovery, but thankfully not absolute damage. And the border wall, you know, there are no, I believe that with the exception of some stretches in Texas that are still tied up in eminent domain court cases where landowners don't want their land seized for the wall. But I believe except for those instances, which are small in the total length of the wall, that what has been authorized has already been constructed. The damage is done and continues. And, of course, you know, in presidential politics and in congressional politics, we have heard frequent calls to wall off the entire border, and that would be unthinkable catastrophe for jaguars and for you know, other endangered wildlife.
Right. Yeah. So I want to ask you the same question I asked you earlier about Mexican gray wolves. In your view, what would a sincere effort to recover jaguars actually look like? What really needs to happen here?
Well, completing the jaguar recovery plan and putting it on a sound scientific basis, which is not the direction that we've seen from Fish and Wildlife Service. They came out with an outline of a recovery plan that would have allowed them, and so it's not even a draft yet. It was an outline. But if they follow in the same route, it's going to be very problematic because they seem to be going in the direction of saying that jaguars could be taken off the endangered species list and declared recovered, even if there are no jaguars in the United States, that recovery would take place entirely south of the border. And the logic behind that, again, I think it's very sophisticated and deliberately obfuscates the biological needs of the jaguar. The logic of it is, well, there's a lot more jaguars south of the border than there are north of the border, which is obvious. There's only one north of the border. That's why it's an endangered animal, as there's so few of them. But that doesn't mean that's the way it always was. And jaguars actually evolved in North America thousands of years before they expanded their range into South America, and then many thousands of years later, they were extirpated. They were killed off throughout most of their original range here in the United States, the place that they were originally. So it makes sense to look at the areas that might still be able to support them for recovery, both to help the jaguar population in northern Mexico, which may very well be cut off from further jaguars south, so genetically isolated. If you could expand that to include range such as in the Gila, that would still be connected, that jaguars could still walk back and forth in, that would give the jaguars in northern Mexico a much better shot at long-term survival. And it would also help fulfill the first stated intent of the Endangered Species Act, which is to conserve the ecosystems on which endangered species depend. And certainly we have a lot of unique ecosystems in North America that are very different from ecosystems in Mexico and Central and South America. And, you know, we're never going to get jaguars back in California, for example, Southern California, where they were known to exist. We're never going to get jaguars back to Kentucky, where they were even known to exist centuries ago. But there is no biological reason they couldn't be returned to the Gila National Forest, where there's excellent habitat for them, and they should be. So that should be incorporated into a recovery plan. And critical habitat really should be expanded to protect areas up here in the Gila area, where jaguars could make a go of it.
Well, we just have about a minute left in the show, Michael. I wanted to ask you, if people want to learn more or to get involved, what suggestions do you have for our listeners?
Well, certainly our website, www.biologicaldiversity.org, is a wealth of information on Mexican gray wolves and on jaguars and on getting involved with other endangered species protection campaigns and our broader campaigns for the climate and for population and sustainability. And there's a lot that one can do as independently as well. Become a member of the center, but also just write letters to the editor supporting these endangered wildlife. Write to members of our senators, our governor, and the like. Thanks.
Thank you, Michael, for joining me on today's show. Thanks to Kyle Johnson, and thank you to our listeners. Join us next week.